this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580 in Urbana, Illinois. We've got a live show to you coming today on February 15th, the one-year anniversary of the enormous global peace protest against the U.S. Invasion of Iraq that took place. It's been the story of the last year. And today on our show, we've got a show I've been looking forward to for a long time. As our guest, we're bringing on one of the premier political satirists of our times and a best-selling author, Al Franken. Al Franken's the author of, among other things, the new book, Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them, A Fair and Balanced Look at the Right. And he is about to venture into a career as a radio talk show host. Al, are you there?
I am.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Al.
My pleasure.
I really appreciate it. You're in Boston, I take it? Is that right?
Yep.
Okay. Are you working on another book? Because the last time you were in Boston at Harvard, you came out with Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them.
Yeah, actually, I came up here to do a number of things. One of them was have dinner with some of the Team Franken members who helped me research the book. But I'm not working on a book now. I'm gearing up for my radio show.
When does the show start?
March 31st.
And it's what network is it going to be on, and how many stations going to carry it?
The network is our own network. It's called Air America Radio.
Mm-hmm.
Air America, like the original Air America, will be going through the air. It's American and funded by the CIA. We have right now, I know we have stations in New York, Chicago, and L.A., and I believe we're getting them in a number of other markets. And then we're doing something that I don't think has been done before. We're sort of starting a network from the ground up, and these are stations we're either buying or leasing right now, and then hopefully as we are on the air and people become affiliates, and we'll have stations all over the place.
So you'll be on Monday through Friday, 2 or 3 hours a day?
I'm going to be on Monday through Friday, 3 hours a day.
Are you going head-to-head against Rush Limbaugh? Is that the point?
I am, actually. I'm going to, as far as I know, yeah, I'm noon to 3, so Eastern time. But I'm going to try to do mine drug-free.
Yeah, I've been touting that as I promoted the show, because I think that really is going to be a contribution to our media culture.
Yeah, I don't know if it's ever been done before. But
yeah, it'll be an interesting test. You know, one of the things, if you look at talk radio in the United States, which has emerged as this enormous political forum, if someone were to come to the United States from another planet or another country and just listen to our radio, know nothing else about the country, they would assume that right-wing politicians would get 99% of the vote in elections, and that anyone who opposed them would have the IQ of about 40, would be an utter idiot. You know, why is there this imbalance? Why is it that your show is going to be so striking? Because it'll be going against the grain of what is talk radio in the United States.
Well, I think maybe to their credit, and I hate to say that, but I say it grudgingly, they captured it, and Rush did capture it about 12 years ago, and it seems like the whole landscape of talk radio is right-wing, and that's why I couldn't see doing a show that was syndicated, because any talk radio station would have on it Rush and Sean Hannity and Bill O'Reilly, and then local right-wing guys, and you can't fit a left-wing or liberal show in the middle of that, because it would be like doing country, hip-hop, country. And it's just not, radio, if anything, is about format. So the only alternative was really to form this network, and that's what we're doing.
And there will be other shows of a liberal or progressive persuasion besides
that? Yeah, before me is Liz Topp. Liz Topp is a friend of mine. Liz Winstead, who was a co-creator of The Daily Show. And I guess Randy Rhodes is after me, and she's a liberal talker from Southern Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And Bobby Kennedy is going to be doing a show weekly. And I think we have 14 to 16-hour programming a day, and we're not going to cede this territory anymore.
We're talking to Al Franken today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. If you want to call in with a question or comment for Al Franken, the number here, 333-9455. The toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Al, Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them, a book which I devoured on one plane flight right after it came out. It says on the cover it's the number one New York Times best-selling book. Were you surprised at how well the book did? Or has done, I should say, not just did, because it's still in its lifespan right now.
Yeah, next week I guess it'll be number 5 in its 25th week on New York Times. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we did get a boost from the lawsuit from Fox. That really helped, and thank you if anyone from Fox is listening, which I doubt. You know, I had this run-in, this dust-up with O'Reilly in May 31st of last year and at this book expo in L.A. when we were promoting our books to booksellers. And I was on a panel with Molly Ivins and Bill and myself, and Molly was pushing her book Bushwhacked, and Bill was pushing his book Living with Herpes, which is a very good book because when you write from your experience, you know, it's usually a good thing. And Bill didn't like the fact that he was on the cover of my book, Lies and Lying Liars Who Tell Them, along with President Bush and Vice President Cheney and Ann Coulter.
That's quite a team you got there.
Yeah, and he sort of went after me, and he said things like, I don't call people liars, that's not what I do. And evidently he hasn't actually listened to his own show or watched his show. And so I decided, well, that he deserved to, I owed it to him to explain why he was on the cover of a book that had the words lies and lying liars. And so I got up, and I using Nexus transcripts, basically proved not only that he was a liar, but kind of a pathological liar. And everyone enjoyed it, except for Bill, who said, "Shut up! You've had your 35 minutes. Shut up!" And I had only spoken for 20, which proves that he can't even tell you to shut up without lying. And he was really mad, and that was a Friday. The next time I went on the radio, he said that if this had been the Old West, we would have had to have a shootout, which I thought was very interesting. But what was even more interesting is that he guaranteed to his listening audience that he would have won this shootout, which would have taken place, I don't know, 130 years ago, and which I thought was odd because I don't know if you know this, Bob, but every year I go during the summers. I go on the state fair quick draw circuit.
No, I was unfamiliar with that.
Yeah, and I'm third in the country.
And I assume he's not one or two.
He is not.
Mm-hmm.
So, and nevertheless, he guaranteed his audience that he would prevail. In fact, he said, "I guaranteed I'd have shot him." And he said, "This is a quote, between the head." So then, anyway, this led into this lawsuit, and the lawsuit, of course, propelled the book to number one on Amazon before the book was out, and so I think that put the book into orbit. I think what sustained the book, and a book doesn't sustain as long as it has, it's now 25 weeks on the list, is that people like it.
Yeah, and I having read it, it's an excellent book. And we've had a lot of authors on. There's really a whole booming genre of books that have come out, I think, by liberals who are sort of fed up with getting kicked around. We've had Paul Krugman. We're going to have Molly Ivins on the air shortly. We've had Joe Connison. Just a lot of books out there now.
It's great.
Yeah, and they're all doing well, it seems like.
Yeah, right? And you know, the Paul O'Neill book, or the Susskind book about Paul O'Neill. The Kevin Phillips book about the Bush dynasty. Those are 1-2.
Were you surprised at all? I don't know how much of the Susskind book you've had a chance to read or the excerpts. Were you surprised at the way President Bush was presented in that book?
You mean as disengaged?
Yeah, I mean even more than I think a lot of people suspected.
Well, not really. Susskind is also the author of the Esquire article, Profile on Rove, which included the document, the DiUlio memo, which you'll remember, which is John DiUlio was the head of the faith-based initiative for a while, University of Pennsylvania, a professor who was actually a Democrat, so it was part of I'm going to have a bipartisan cabinet, and he didn't get much done in the faith-based. I think they got the faith-based Bureau of Weights and Measures started. But anyway, DeLulio wrote a memo to Susskind, who was writing this article on Rove, and DeLulio basically said that that this was an unprecedented administration in that it had no domestic policy apparatus, and that it was in total contrast to the Clinton White House, where policy was extremely important, that obviously the Clinton administration cared about politics and cared about the political impact, you know, implications of policy, but that the president was actually interested in policy, and that in the and they brought in policy experts when, like, for example, let's say they had, remember, if you read Bob Rubin's book, when he first came in as Secretary of Treasury, the thing that was facing him was the possible default of Mexico, and they had to make a decision whether to bail out Mexico, and they had to, the executive branch sort of had to do it unilaterally with this currency destabilization money that they could use once, basically, and that had been set up, I guess, in the 30s or something, and they did it, but they did it while very, very carefully weighing things and very carefully, in very nuanced ways, talking about it, but the president was fully engaged. And in O'Neill's book, or in Susskind's book about O'Neill, and in the DeLulio memo, you get this picture of a White House that doesn't really care about policy because the president doesn't care about policy. And there is the fact that O'Neill talks, whenever he has a meeting with the president doesn't say anything. And this was at a gridiron dinner, so it was supposed to be a joke. Not a gridiron dinner, but alfalfa dinner, I think. Mm-hmm. The president said, well, the reason I didn't say anything is I was bored. And the joke, I think, was supposed to be how boring O'Neill was. I think that's the joke. But it's really, he was boring about our economy. There's a lot of numbers there, things like that. And so, the most startling thing to me in that whole book, and I haven't read the book, but I mean, in the excerpts that I've read, is that even Bush understood after 9/11 that there was something wrong with giving another tax cut to those at the top. I mean, he had a flash, and there's a transcript of a meeting in which Bush says they're talking about the second wave of tax cuts for those in the top 1%. And Bush actually says, didn't we do this before? Didn't we just give a tax cut to the rich?
Yeah, haven't they already given enough to the rich?
Yeah, and especially since we're at war, and you can just, Rove, like calls time out and explains to him, this is our principles.
Yeah, no, stick to principles, he said.
Got to stick to principles.
Yeah, that's the principle.
Yeah. The principle on getting rid of the estate tax is that the estate tax punishes the most productive among us, the children of very wealthy people.
We're talking to Al Franken today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment, the number is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Al, this show is carried on the Internet, you'll be glad to know, as I suspect yours will be. And we have a caller right now from Ithaca, New York.
Great.
Ithaca, you're on the air with Al Franken.
Great. Thanks for having me. Oh, I love your new book.
And thank you. I can barely hear you, so talk up.
I'll talk up. So I really enjoyed your new book and found the fact that it was very research-oriented to be helpful. I hope your new radio show will be done in a similar vein. And I really think that there's a need for an alternative to the majority of what we hear on talk radio. And my question actually involves the Internet. So I'm wondering if you guys will be doing some streaming of either real audio or some MP3 streaming, so people who live in communities that aren't otherwise able to get your show can get it.
Yes, we will be streamed on the Internet, and I don't know what format it'll be in. I'm sort of not very technical myself, but I think we will be, however you stream it.
Yeah,
we're going to be streamed.
I don't think they're going to have you working the board, Al. I don't think you have to worry about that.
No, but, I wish that I was literally using my computer only for word processing until about 4 years ago.
Mm.
And I was in DOS. I turn my computer on and go to the C prompt.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah, and I go to WP, mm-hmm. and that would be Word Perfect, and then I'd write. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know you could use a computer for anything else. But then my students at Harvard here taught me a lot about. They're amazingly literate on how to use computers. So we will, yeah, we'll have a web presence in terms of having a website for the show and for the network, and we will be streamed.
You know, Rush Limbaugh's show, and I've listened to it several times. I don't know if you have, but I don't know if I've ever heard him go against sort of the Republican National Committee position on an issue. I've never heard him, you know, stinging rebuke of the president on an issue. Now, maybe
well,
I missed
they
it.
They do this every once in a while. They have sort of a so in order to present the fiction that they're not wholly owned subsidiaries of the Republican National Committee, they will every once in a while take a position counter. But it usually is only sort of helpful to the president ultimately that somebody is challenging them. Like, I think Rush has recently accused the president of spending too much money.
Mm.
And, of course, that means, you know, cutting back on discretionary spending for, you know, things like schools and Medicaid and stuff like that. I don't think he's been critical of him on anything, you know, homeland security or, you know, military spending. And I think, you know, someone like Hannity, who is just a complete right-wing bulldog, movement conservative robot, criticized the president on the steel tariffs.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So I think that's it.
Yeah, I think you've hit that. I think that's about
but,
it.
Now, you know, sure. It's sort of the exception that proves the rule.
Now, your book, you deal with Hannity quite a bit,
right.
And Hannity and his show, as some people may be familiar, has a liberal counterbalance to him.
Well, yeah, on his TV show.
On his TV show, named Alan Colmes.
Mm-hmm.
Colmes doesn't really come glowing through the pages of your book.
Well, Colmes is, part of it is it's sort of a setup. Colmes is a sort of moderately liberal guy and a moderate guy in his manner, and Hannity is a propaganda machine who will lie. And I've discovered through talking to Colmes, I went up to him at a White House correspondence dinner, and I write about this in the book, and I said, I think I have some ammunition for you for your show. Hannity at this point had been criticizing Democrats for undermining the commander-in-chief while we had men and women in harm's way in Iraq. And I guess, and all Hannity really was referring to was like Daschle saying that we had had a diplomatic failure. And actually, he said that before the war started. But I went back and I nexused what Hannity had said on Hannity and Colmes during the war in Kosovo. And he had said things like, President Clinton doesn't know what he's doing, he's not following what the generals are saying. This is while they're fighting. That we're running out of ammunition, things like that, right? So I said to Colmes, I mean, there's much, 100 times worse stuff that Hannity himself was saying while we had men and women in harm's way in Kosovo to undermine the commander-in-chief. And Hannity said to me, oh, that's interesting. I went, interesting, you're going to use it, aren't you? And he said, well, that's not the format of our show. I said, what? Well, I said, we don't go after each other. We just go after the guests. I said, oh. So what they got is a guy who lies and a guy who doesn't lie. But the guy who lies, who this is Fox's version of Fair and Balance. So Hannity will, like, I remember after the State of the Union address last year, said that 90 million Americans are going to receive an $1,100 tax cut, which wasn't true at all. 90 million Americans were getting a tax cut. The average tax cut was $1,100, but that's because people like Cheney and Bill Gates and President Bush were getting huge tax cuts, but most people were getting like $300 or less. So, but Hannity would say 90 million people are getting $1,100 tax cut, and Colmes wouldn't say anything. And I asked him about this. He said, well, our job, he said, I have said things like, so I said, yeah, I've seen you do it like 5 minutes later, say something. Like, that's an average, but then not really push him on it.
During the
commercial
break.
And then he'll repeat
break,
it later. He'll repeat it on, you know, 2 days later or a day later.
Mm-hmm.
And then you won't say anything. You'll say something every eighth time. And he said, well, we're not supposed to go after each other. I said, well, could you, like, talk to him after the show and say, don't do that? And he said, well, that's not really the nature of our, and I went, relationship. And it's, so, the problem is that he has accepted this job, and the job really is to present the facade of a fair and balanced show, and it isn't. It just is not.
Yeah, in effect, in the book, for those who have not yet read it, when the name Combs appears, I think you use, like, four-point type.
Or six, very, very small type.
Very, very small type. So it's Hannity and then Combs in very small type.
Yeah.
We've got a full bank of phone lines to talk to Al Franken, our guest today in Media Matters. Let's get back to the phone lines. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air with Al Franken.
Hello. Can you say something about the heroic military service of our commander-in-chief? I heard a story on NPR. Someone said that there's a story where Bush said that it was either serving in the National Guard or shooting himself in the foot. Do you know? Have you heard about that? Is that apocryphal?
Well, it sounds apocryphal to me. I don't think he's stupid, but
he's not that stupid.
I don't know. He unless somebody reported that he said that. I think he basically. I mean, you know, we know what this is. We all know what this is. He's a rich kid, and he got above. You know, he was placed in the Air National Guard, which had no danger of going to Vietnam. And he, no one really cared that much if he showed up or not. And he, you know, may or may not have shown up. And, you know, the thing is, if I had been Russert on the Meet the Press last week, I would have just said, like, you know, I didn't serve in the military, Mr. President, like, you know, like you did. But I know that it's supposed to be a real bonding experience, so you must have a lot of great stories about your service in the Air National Guard in Alabama. Who were your favorite pals then? There must have been some real characters. What were they like? What was your favorite bar? I know you're quite a hellraiser then. And also, Mr. President, you know, I think we all appreciated it when finally on the cocaine you just ended up by saying, look, when I was young and irresponsible, I was young and irresponsible. I mean, that was a great answer. All of us adults knew what it meant, and we were relieved that our kids didn't have to hear that a potential president, a presidential candidate, now president, didn't have to say, yes, I snorted cocaine. I mean, that was a great answer. Thank you for that answer. A lot of people have suggested that maybe you didn't show up for your physical because they were had instituted drug testing at that point, and that you didn't want to test positive for, you know, for pot and cocaine and acid or whatever it was you were taking when you were young and irresponsible. How's that theory hold up to you? Those are the questions I would have asked.
Oh, very good.
Yeah, you know, I saw a study that someone did, one of these Nexus surveys, on the coverage of Bill Clinton and his military record and George W. Bush's military record. And this was done in 2001 or 2002, so it was before this flap developed. And the ratio of stories in the news media was on the order of, I'm ballparking it, but say 50 or 100 to 1.
Sure.
I mean, the Clinton issue was just all over the place. Everyone knew about Clinton, the draft dodger.
Right.
And Bush's military record basically unexamined until quite recently.
Well, this speaks really to what happened in 2000 where Bush got a pass. And it was very disgraceful. And they were just too busy going after Gore. And going after apocryphal things like I invented the internet, which he never said, and I was the one who discovered Love Canal, which he never said, and that he lied about Love Story, which he didn't. And, you know, they were just too busy doing that.
But do you think this current flap over Bush's military service, do you think they're going to be able to sort of, you know, sweep this under the rug? Where do you see this heading? Any sense?
Well, it seems like from the documentation, they finally found a guy who claims to have seen him there. It's very odd that only, you know, they, first of all, it doesn't sound like Bush could remember anybody who was there in Alabama. I know, like, I went to wrestling camp when I was like in high school for like 4 days. I remember guys who were there. You know, I don't understand how you don't remember the guys you served with in the National Guard. So, but they found someone who says he saw him reading a manual, which is suspicious to me because I don't see Bush actually reading a manual. But I think this will definitely have.
Well, we don't know what the manual was for, though. So that
no, it was for the, evidently for the plane.
Oh, okay.
For the plane he was flying, a big jet plane. Anyway, so I think this is going to have legs. And one of the funny things about this is that the Republicans send out the memo, which is that Democrats who are bringing this up are attacking the National Guard. And so that's what you're going to hear a lot about, like, these Democrats are attacking the services, and you know, and the National Guardsmen, by the way, now are very different from the National Guard 30 years ago. I just came back from a month and a half ago from Iraq. I was in Kuwait, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Uzbekistan on a USO tour, and there are a tremendous amount of Guard there now. I think during Vietnam, there were very, very few guards that went overseas.
And isn't the issue not about the guard, but rather that he didn't even do what guard service he was supposed
yeah,
to do?
Yeah, no. I mean, he's not being criticized for being in the guard. He's being criticized for not being in the guard.
Yeah, yeah. We're talking to Al Franken today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We've got a line open at 333-9455, and we've got some very patient callers. Let's go back to the phones. Line 3, Champagne, you're on the air with Al Franken.
Well, hello. I'm a professor at the university here. It's really an honor to hear you here in Illinois. Just a quick question. Last year, for example, the only dissent we heard at all about the war was on a comedy show on Comedy Central, Jon Stewart. And it seems that the only dissent one hears at all is on comedy shows, your books and Michael Moore, for example. I just wonder if you could comment on that and tell us if you'll have any non-comedic dissent in your network.
Well, I hope to make our network entertaining, but I do hope to have serious people on who are, you know, that we present in an interesting, compelling way. I mean, you can be an entertaining show without always being funny. You can be an entertaining show presenting. For example, I guess I'd love to have is James Fallows, who just wrote a piece in The Atlantic Monthly. I don't know if you saw this, Bob.
Not yet.
It's a great piece on how Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and Cheney and all those guys completely, willfully ignored all the planning that was done for a post-invasion Iraq.
Hmm.
And it's a chilling article. It's a great article. I recommend it to all your readers. So, yes, we'll be doing stuff that probably isn't that funny, but hopefully is compelling and interesting. But we have a different mission than a straight-ahead NPR show, or for that matter, NPR to me is straight ahead news, and it isn't biased one way or another. Our mission is to sort of stop seeding this terrain of radio on in political advocacy. So we're going to be a left wing or liberal radio show, and I'm not that left wing. I'm like a Clinton Democrat. I'm like a Hubert. I grew up in Minnesota. I'm a Hubert Humphrey Democrat. And but we're going to be funny and entertaining, and also present the, you know, and I want to have right-wing people on. I want to have, you know, friends of mine. Like, I have a lot of right-wing friends. G. Gordon Liddy is a friend of mine. I want to have G on whenever we break into something. I'm a big Bob Murray fan, so we'll be doing, like, original comedy and that sort of thing. And I have a co-host, Catherine Lanfer, who did Minnesota Public Radio for 5.5 years, had a 2-hour mid-morning show. It was the only mid-morning show for an NPR affiliate that built on Morning Edition. So we're going to have a substantive but entertaining, or a substantive and entertaining show that you can tune into.
And I should say that Al Franken, your new book, Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them, while being quite entertaining, as one caller already pointed out, is heavily researched and documented. And one chapter in particular, and you and I spoke about this off air and on another occasion, dealing with Paul Wellstone and how his funeral and death were spun. There's not a funny word in that chapter. It's the longest chapter in the book. And for anyone who knows Paul Wellstone or admires him, it's, I think, the most chilling chapter in the book. You knew Paul Wellstone, I assume, since you're from Minnesota.
Yeah. I mean, I was at the memorial, and one of 20 people in the hall, and there were 4,000 people next door in a overflow room watching on video, and that room was full, and then there was other people outside watching on screens on a very cold November night. And Rush Limbaugh the next day said, "Everyone knows it was a planted house." And they had an hour before the memorial, Twin Cities radio and TV had to go on and tell people, just don't bother going.
Mm-hmm.
It's overflow, you know, it's full.
Yeah.
And I got there 3 hours ahead of time, and the place was already full. And it was incredibly moving memorial. There were some moments from it that, out of grief, a few people said some things. Not really a few people, actually, one.
Paul's best friend.
That,
yeah.
You know, said that Republican friends of Wellstone's should support Mondale, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And that was inappropriate, and then that was just excerpted, and there were just a tremendous amount of lies spread, like that Trent Lott had been booed by 20,000 people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I, this to me was the centerpiece of the book, because I really believe that the right-wing echo chamber, which exists and which is Rush is part of, and Rush did a brilliant job the next day of saying, there was no memorial. There was no grieving. And if you went there, it was 3.5 to 4 hours of emotion. And there were unbelievable eulogies, and eulogies for like David McLaughlin's eulogy for his brother, Will McLaughlin, who was a driver, was Paul's driver, was unbelievably beautiful. And Christopher Caldwell from the Weekly Standard wrote a thing saying the other aides who died in the plane crash were barely treated at all, and that's not true. It's just not true.
Mm-hmm.
And I called Chris, and Chris said the 20,000 people booed in rapid succession, and he named all these people that were not booed.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked Chris if some of the stuff I've liked on the Weekly Standard and stuff. I asked him, it basically turned out that Chris had never seen the thing. And this was, Tucker Carlson said that that the Republican senators who showed up to pay their respects were shouted down as they tried to speak. And that really didn't happen because the speakers were all chosen ahead of time. They were chosen by the families. There was just lie after lie after lie. And polling evidence shows that people's reaction to not the memorial itself, but to the spin about the memorial, the very dishonest spin about the memorial, affected the election. Not just in Minnesota, but in Missouri and all over the country. And so this was sort of my center. It was, in a way, it was the hardest chapter to write. And I had 14 students, and I would show them the memorial. I had a tape of the memorial, and every time I'd play the tape, I'd start crying. And I had these poor students who had thought that their teacher was having a nervous breakdown. But Paul was an amazing guy.
He was indeed. We're talking to Al Franken today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We still have time for some callers. The number is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We've got a couple of people who have been very patient. Line 4, Dixon, Illinois, you're on the air with Al Franken.
Yeah. I remember how funny George Carlin was using language as a subject sometimes. I was reading today a Rockridge Institute, a fellow named George Lakoff, and he talks about framing issues through the way the right wing has manipulated the language. I was wondering if you heard of this fella and if you were working on anything in terms of the things that George Lakoff is talking about.
No, how do you spell his name?
Lakoff.
Lakoff.
It's Rockwood or Rockridge Institute. He's on the internet.
Okay.
And he talks about one of the things he said is tax relief. assumes that people need relief because they're being victimized.
Right. The death tax is a perfect use of language.
Yeah, so I was wondering, you know, if you had any thoughts about using language itself and reframing the issues in terms of that.
Well, I mean, I've talked about that, especially in terms of things like the death tax.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't know. Have I used this joke already? But
no, I think you go ahead. You're safe.
I don't know. That the estate tax punishes the...
you have used that.
Oh, okay. Right.
See, you got to save here.
That's a new joke for me.
It worked, yeah. It probably worked the second time.
And just in case those of you who've come in the middle of the show, the estate tax punishes the most...
I thought family values would be a great way to...
Let me do the...
Let him finish the joke.
Okay, that the estate tax punishes the most productive among us, the children of the very wealthy.
All right.
Thank you, caller.
You know, one thing I just wanted to ask you about, we've got a bunch of callers I want to get to, but I know that a lot of people off air asked me to raise this with you, is the 2004 presidential election.
Mm-hmm.
What's your sense of the Democratic field right now? What's your sense of how things are progressing this year?
Well, I think now Kerry has gotten to the point where he's a prohibitive favorite. I think Edwards is, Edwards and Dean are clearly hanging in case something happens. I think we've only selected, a quarter or a little bit more than a quarter of the delegates, or maybe not that many.
Mm-hmm.
So I like it to continue to play out because I like when the focus is on us.
Did you have a personal favorite, or do you have a personal favorite?
I've not endorsed anyone. I've done events for Kerry, and I've done events for Dean. I did events for Gephardt.
What is your sense right now? What's your are you optimistic as a Democrat?
I am, and I would do events for Edwards, or I would have.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, I'm just at this point, you do an event for anybody, it looks like you're endorsing them.
Yeah.
But before, I was just sort of raising money for each of them so they could run negative ads against each other.
So you're optimistic, you said.
I'm optimistic. Well, I'm optimistic because I think that Kerry is a guy. In the book, I wrote this piece called Operation Chicken Hawk, in which Bush and Cheney and Ashcroft and Bill O'Reilly and Clarence Thomas serve on Kerry's Swift boat in Vietnam. And in order to research that, I talked at great length to another Swift boat captain or commander, a guy named Wade Sanders, who actually was an undersecretary of the Navy. And he was a Swift boat commander at the same time that Kerry was in Vietnam. And the way he talked about him, I knew that he just commanded tremendous respect among everybody in the Swift boat fleet, and that the way he won a Silver Star, the guy just has balls of steel. And I watched pretty closely his last Senate race against Weld.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's a tough, tough guy. I think that's what we need. I think we also need to give Howard Dean his props for jolting us and jolting this field.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I did events for him.
We're talking to Al Franken today in Media Matters. We've got a full bank of phone callers. I want to get to all of them, so let's go back to the phone lines. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with Al Franken.
Yeah, I just got your book last night. You mentioned the topic on the chapter Operation Ignore.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a really important one. But I had a comment and a question.
Mm-hmm.
That is that I think you should know if you're starting up a new network that at least one conservative talk show investigates its anonymous liberal callers. And I know that for a fact because they investigated me in another state. But here's a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
I saw you on a panel with Bill O'Reilly. I saw you on that panel you were mentioning with Bill O'Reilly.
Mm-hmm.
And Molly Ivins and all that. And I'm afraid I think O'Reilly really outdid you in the shouting match, but And I'm not sure I would have had a better response than you did, but do you not regret having gotten up and punched him out?
So you mean not punching him?
No, punching him out. I mean, yeah, do you regret not punching him out? Right.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm not a violent person. And
except for the gunshots.
Huh?
Except for the gun shooting.
Well, yeah, no, the quick draw contest is just a harken back to the past. It's really a traditionalist thing that I do. No, of course I don't regret not doing that. I think that he, I think the more he shouted and the more obnoxious he was, the bigger the hole he dug for himself.
In the book, you really go after O'Reilly, but there's a whole coterie of these right-wing pundits and politicians who you analyze and inspect. And probably the lead person, the first picture in the cover, is Ann Coulter.
Right.
And I've had callers on this show who've been supporters of Ann Coulter, and their defense of her is that in her, I guess it's her penultimate book now, I haven't seen her latest book, she has, I guess, scads of footnotes to document her claims. And you did something that we were taught to do in grad school and at universities, but the general public isn't taught to. You actually went and checked her footnotes.
Right.
And to see exactly how good they were, how much they proved what she claimed. What did you find?
Well, that they were, it's unbelievable the way first of all, she doesn't have footnotes, she has endnotes.
Oh, endnotes, excuse me. Yeah.
I do a little thing on how to lie with footnotes, and number one is don't have footnotes, have endnotes. And the difference between footnotes and endnotes is that if the endnotes are as fraudulent as hers are, if they're at the bottom, you can see how fraudulent they are if they're at the bottom of the page. And if you have 780 of them, her readers aren't going to check them. So, I mean, for example, I use an example of something that she writes in this thing about saying that the New York Times wrote an editorial about Clarence Thomas called The Meanest, Cruelest Justice. That's actually the title of a... this is what she's saying. It's actually the title of an editorial in the newspaper of record. And then she switches to the passive tense. She says, Thomas is not challenged on his judicial philosophy. He is called a race traitor, a chicken and biscuit eating Uncle Tom. And then she does a lot of quotes like that and deliberately makes it look like the New York Times used this. And she says all this from the Champions of Intolerance. Or the whatever.
Yeah, the Champions of Tolerance.
Of Tolerance.
Yeah.
And, of course, the New York Times didn't say that at all. And you have to go back into one of the 780 endnotes to find out this is something that Joyce Lynn Elder said in the Playboy interview.
About the New York Times.
Not about the New York Times, about Clarence Thomas.
Oh, I see.
See what I mean? She called him a chicken and biscuit eating Uncle Tom, not the New York Times.
I see.
Or she'll do a thing like... she'll put an end note on something. She'll say, Jesse Jackson gave this speech in Britain that accused somebody of being fascist. And then the New York Times didn't cover this at all. You go back to her end note, and she said, I did a nexus search using, and then she overloaded a nexus search. So she put in like 8 terms in the nexus search and to prove that they didn't cover it. Well, we just put in 3 search terms and found they did. And this would be like, you could use this technique to prove anything. So we use it to prove that the Washington Times didn't cover Bush throwing up on the Japanese prime minister by putting in Bush, Japanese prime minister, tossing cookies. I mean, it's just, she does this all the time. Or she'll put in something and the end note will ultimately just contradict what she says. She'll say something like, and everyone, you know, that the consortium in Florida proved that Bush would have won in any way they counted the votes. And then you go back to the end note and you'll see a thing says, Gore would have won in overcount, in the end note. That was the subtitle of the article. Bush would have won. I mean, Gore would have won if overvotes were counted.
Yeah. We're talking to Al. Okay, go ahead, Al.
Just contradict exactly what she says.
Yeah, we're talking to Al Franken today on Media Matters. We've got a full bank of phone callers. I'm going to try to get to all of them before we check out in nine minutes. So let's go back to the phone lines. And the first one up is going to be Line 3 Champagne. You're on the air with Al Franken.
Is that me?
That's you, sir.
Okay. I would just like to ask Mr. Franken about this story that's floating around about Kerry and an affair, which apparently the London Telegraph has done a little piece on, quoting the father of the supposed intern, referring to Kerry as a sleazebag and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think there's any substance to this story? And I'm just going to hang up and listen, okay?
Okay.
Yeah, this story is getting a lot of play, I think, in Europe. My wife sees it in the European media, but hasn't, to my knowledge, gotten a lot of play yet here.
Well, I think this started with Drudge, who picked it up from some right-wing blog site. And this is the right-wing echo chamber. And, I mean, I've been the victim of that recently myself. I was up in New Hampshire, and there was a protester at a Dean rally, and he started screaming, and Dean asked that they get the guy out. And it took about 10 minutes of the guy continuing to scream, I went back and to see what was happening. And the security people were Dean people. And they were kind of had the guy by the shoulders and were just sort of asking him to leave. And this was totally disrupting the meeting. People, it was like a town meeting where people were supposed to ask questions and no one could. So I asked if they needed help. And at that point, the guy jumped. They said yes. The guy headed, bolted toward the front, and two of the Dean people and I helped stop him. And then he grabbed onto a railing. I said to them, I think if we take his legs out, we can get him out of here. So I went down and got his legs, knowing that they had his shoulders and knowing he was holding onto the rail. But I got his feet off the ground so he couldn't get any purchase on the ground, and that got him off balance, and they were able to take the guy out. The guy was not hurt in the least. And then some guy from the New York Post wrote a piece saying about this, that Al Franken body slammed a guy.
No, actually, I heard about this.
Yeah, to the ground, and that
I was impressed.
Yeah, that I ran across the room and tackled him, slammed him to the ground. And, you know, and it just wasn't true, and you know, then suddenly it was showing up all over the place that, you know, why couldn't I have let security handle this? And how dare I be so violent? And now, actually, later today, I'm going up to Manchester to receive the key to the city from the mayor of Manchester.
Very good.
Yeah.
Well, so what about this Kerry stuff? I mean, do you think, whether this story is true or not, or garbage or whatever, do you expect we're going to have an election year that Kerry's about to have as I think Arianna Huffington called it, a mudslide coming on top of him for the next 7 months?
Yeah, and I think that's why it's nice to have a guy with balls of steel.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think he'll be able to fight it. He'll be able to fight it more effectively than other people have, than other Democrats have. Now, you know what they did to John McCain in South Carolina. They were doing push polling where they were saying that John McCain had fathered an illegitimate black child and things like that. So these guys rove, and those guys are capable of anything.
I mean, with the reputation they have, do you think it's not as effective anymore? I mean, do you think that at some point that approach just doesn't work? I mean, it might get your own troops galvanized, but for the swing voters, you need to win an election. It just won't work.
Yeah, I think it can backfire.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think that it's pretty evident what this is. It's coming from Drudge, and it's coming from right-wing blogs. And I think that if the press is awake now to actually investigate the president's military record, they might be awake enough now to report on the kind of things and the kind of person Karl Rove is.
Yeah.
Karl Rove has a history of incredibly dirty tricks.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phone line, Sal. Line 1, Chicago, thank you for your patience. You're on with Al Franken.
Yeah, hi. By the way, I'm not happy about the handling by the Democrats of the propaganda that's coming out of the Republican machine. I don't. Basically, their patron saint is Goebbels, the former propaganda minister of the
I remember Goering.
The Nazis, and they use the same methods as he used, and essentially they have to be overwhelmed by superior material and greater volume that's presently coming out. Anyhow, the reason I called was that there was an article by Seymour Hersh in the New Yorker about 6 weeks ago or so, which I haven't seen any comment on, and I think it's a...
It's about the stove piping?
Pardon?
Is this about the stove piping?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
You want to take it, or shall I go into it?
No, go ahead, Al, because we only have, like, a very short period of time. Al,
well, I think what you're talking about is the Office of Special Plans within
right,
the Pentagon.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, basically, this is what frustrated me about the about Kay and his testimony and about this investigation into intelligence. Basically, what Seymour Hersh reported was that Wolfowitz set up this Office of Special Plans, which was stovepiping intelligence directly to the White House, circumventing the CIA, and the information they were getting was from Chalabi and his fellows, who were basically fooling us into believing that the Iraqis had weapons of mass destruction, and none of the stuff was vetted in the normal way that intelligence information is vetted. So what they were feeding to the president and to Cheney, and I think Cheney was just part of this, was what they wanted them to hear. So this isn't about poor intelligence from the CIA. This is about deliberate funneling of misinformation to the White House. And so, and we don't need a commission to figure that out. We had Seymour Hersh figure it out. And I haven't been hearing enough about this at all. This caller raises a great, great point.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 2, Champaign County, very quick, if you could, for Al Franken.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was on earlier, and I got deleted somehow, but it was probably my accident. But I heard you on with Harry Scheer on a discussion about, was sort of both about humor and politics and the fact that most of the opinion formation is coming in the late-night shows and even news people. Maybe I should just... whatever you want to say about that, but you were also citing some survey recently, and I just wonder the whole thing. I hearken back to the question earlier about how much content, and one of the problems with humor is that if you don't have the setup, it makes it harder to talk about something that's, you know, not commonly known, or, you know, so you may need a Twilight Zone conspiracy segment where you actually lampoon the idea that this is going to be...
You were the guy on talking about what I'm doing on my radio show earlier?
No.
You just didn't get on.
Yeah, I think my phone failed me.
Okay,
thanks,
well, anyway.
Thanks, deregulation.
I'm not sure what you mean by the Twilight Zone thing, actually, frankly. Sorry.
Well, that's all right. Look, you know what? Al, I'm hearing the band tuning up in the background.
Oh, okay.
Means they're trying to push me out of the studio. We've just got a few seconds left. Any closing comments for the listeners of Illinois and
well,
cyberspace?
I know that we've got a Chicago station. Hopefully... if we're not on in Champaign-Urbana and the area that you're broadcasting out of, demand it. Demand some AM station carry us, and if not, you can get us on the...
Yeah, and
it's Air America.
Okay, and stay tuned to this program. We'll keep people posted on it.
Yes,
Al Franken, thanks so much for joining us today in Media Matters. Good luck with your radio show.
Thank you, Bob. It was great meeting you in Madison.
Okie dokie, and we'll be back a week from today. See you then.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm meteorologist Ed Kieser, reminding you that the same weather team you rely on during the day on AM 580 brings you accurate, in-depth weather at night on WILL-TV. Be more prepared. Watch your weather weeknights at 9:58 on our companion station, WILL-TV. This is the Information Advantage, WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the University of Illinois.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, mostly sunny and brisk with a high around 30 degrees and northeast winds 15 to 25 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low around 12 degrees and northeast winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny with the high in the lower 30s and east winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. It's 2 p.m. Central Time. A Prairie Home Companion is next.